There's no good story.
Yeah.
I was just walking up a rock and all of a sudden felt pain. I wasn't doing anything out of the ordinary at all.
Yeah. I'm Matt Podolsky, and that's my mom, Candy Podolsky. 1,500 miles into our attempt to thru-hike the entire Appalachian Trail, she got hurt.
I have way better stories to tell about the trail than the injury. I mean, I didn't think it was really a big deal. I thought I was being neurotic when I said I had to have it checked out. I didn't expect this.
Yeah.
Did not see it coming.
My mom had partially torn her Achilles tendon, a relatively common injury for long-distance hikers. She had sustained the injury a week or two earlier while hiking up a steep incline in New York.
And I remember thinking, oh God, whatever this is, I hope it holds. And it did, and I got up there. So I kind of could feel that I hadn't completely torn something.
Right.
But I, you know, then it got better. So I thought, oh no, I just didn't tear anything at all. It was fine.
Yeah.
I was doing 20-mile days. I did a 19-mile day. I did a 20-mile day. I was hiking faster than some of the younger people. Not many. Most of them are faster than me, but I was passing some, and I felt strong and great, you know? I was starting to get to that point where I was seeing the end, like I was ready to see the end, mm-hmm. and I was starting to see the end, but not in a bad way. Oh well, what are you gonna do?
Yeah.
Finish hiking it next year and support you this year. That's what I'm gonna do.
There's definitely a part of me that wants to just be like, well, if you're not hiking, then I'm not gonna hike and I'll just hike whenever you're ready. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I was conflicted. A big part of me wanted to keep going, but I wasn't yet ready to give up on the idea of completing my thru hike with my mom.
Yeah, I think you have to
finish
it.
I don't think I could, like, turn around and take another 2 months off next year, you know?
I know.
Three quarters of the folks who attempt an Appalachian Trail thru hike drop out before they finish. Lots of people quit early on in the hike, when they first start to understand the rigors of long-distance hiking. But my mom had shown enormous grit and determination in the first stages of our hike, proving that she could overcome a serious knee injury and undertake a remarkable physical challenge at age 66.
I feel like I accomplished something pretty monumental.
Yeah.
Even if I weren't ever to do another hike again, I hiked almost 1,500 miles.
Yeah.
That's saying something.
That's true.
You know.
My mom would have to stay off trail for at least 3 weeks, possibly more. I decided to keep hiking. But soon I would face a physical challenge of my own.
Oh gosh. I don't feel fantastic.
And I would soon learn about another physical barrier from the Appalachian Trail's past, a dispute that almost forced a closure of a key section of the trail.
Nobody's told me about any Native American reservation that the trail actually passes through.
This is Common Land, a show about the Appalachian Trail. In this episode, we explore some of the physical barriers that stop Appalachian Trail thru hikers in their tracks.
I'm up on Skaticook Mountain. I believe that's how it's pronounced. I'm not 100% sure. Skaticook.
The correct pronunciation is Skaticook, and I'm sorry in advance because you're going to have to hear me mispronounce it in my field tape quite a bit. Just a few hours previous, my mom had decided to get off trail. I now stood alongside a physical barrier to the Appalachian Trail that most hikers probably don't know about, the Skaticook Reservation.
So last night at our campsite right along 10 Mile River, just a few miles from here, I was just looking at the map, trying to plan out today's hike, and I noticed that there was something labeled the Skaticook Reservation. Luckily I had phone service last night and did a little bit of research, and it turns out that it was one of the very first Native American reservations established in North America. It was actually established before the United States came into existence.
We are an Indian tribe that has been here in the state of Connecticut for well over 300 years.
That's Chief Velke, who's served as the chief of the Scaticoke Tribal Nation since 1987. Velke and I exchanged emails but weren't able to connect for an interview. The audio you just heard was from a 2018 interview recorded for a YouTube series called Street Talk.
We're located, as you indicated, in Kent, Connecticut, and we bordered New York to the west and the Housatonic River to the east. And our land consists now of approximately 400 acres. At one time it was well over 2,400 acres, but over the years it has dwindled down now to 400. Even being 400 acres, we're still the largest reservation here in the state of Connecticut.
The Appalachian Trail was routed through the Scaticoke Reservation right from the beginning, starting in 1937. Although there was no formal agreement, the Scaticoke's relationship with the Appalachian Trail didn't sour until 1978, when representatives from the National Park Service started buying up all the land surrounding the trail. The Scaticoke's were not going to sell. Instead, they filed a federal lawsuit in 1985.
One of the fascinating things that I learned as I was doing a little bit of research last night is that there actually has been some dispute over the Appalachian Trail passing through the Scaticoke Reservation.
That lawsuit was dismissed by the judge, but the Scaticoke Tribal Nation wasn't done fighting. By the year 2000, Chief Velke was in the midst of a decades-long battle to petition the United States government for federal recognition. Although they have been recognized by the state of Connecticut since before the American Revolution, they still weren't acknowledged as a federally recognized tribe. So in June of the year 2000, Velke announced that the Scaticoke Tribal Nation would be temporarily closing the portion of the Appalachian Trail that passed through their land as a way to protest the federal government's inaction in granting the tribe federally recognized status. The protest was canceled at the last minute when Connecticut Attorney General Richard Blumenthal agreed to meet with Velke and discuss his concerns. 4 years later, the Scaticoke Tribal Nation gained federal recognition, only to have their recognition rescinded just a year later.
So they fought tooth and nail in 2003 to 2005 to get us overturned, and they were successful. The state of Connecticut was successful in having our positive determination reversed into a negative. And the main reason why this took place was because the state of Connecticut did not want a third casino in the state.
So the presence of the Appalachian Trail on this reservation was being used by the Scaticoke Tribal Nation in the early 2000s as leverage in their battle to gain federal recognition.
Well, I'm walking on the Appalachian Trail here, right along the border of Connecticut and New York, and came across this little sign posted along the trail that says Scaticoke Mountain AT Relocation. The next 1.4 miles of the AT have been relocated to provide a permanently protected trail. The relocation runs northbound from just south of the New York-Connecticut state line to just north of the Scaticoke campsite. So yeah, the old trail has been totally covered by logs and branches so that it's basically impassable. So nobody will take that section of the trail and walk through the reservation.
We did a relatively large relocation to take the AT off of Scaticoke Indian Reservation land in Kent, Connecticut.
That's Dave Boone, the chair of the Trails Committee for the Connecticut chapter of the Appalachian Mountain Club.
The tribe was seeking federal recognition. They've been trying that for decades to get that recognition. And with the trail on their reservation land, they were still, you know, have the ability to say, we don't want this anymore, and then we would really be stuck. So the Park Service was very helpful. you know, we had a number of reviews, a botanical, environmental, and one, an important one, because it's so close to the reservation land, was a cultural assessment done by Park Service archaeologists. And we had the opportunity to go up there with tribal members. And to me, it was a real eye-opener, because there were things going back thousands of years that were cultural structures or items to them. To me, it might look like a pile of rock, but to these people who know what it means and how what it implies, that was a real eye-opener for me to have that experience and be with those folks as they were looking at these things. So I think we finished that in 2021.
So after decades of contention between the Skaticook Tribal Nation and the AT, the trail was finally rerouted around the reservation just the year before I hiked through in 2022.
But I think that over the years, we've made real progress and have a much stronger relationship with the tribe. And I think a lot of it is due to that, the work during that relocation and meeting face to face and, you know, walking the relocation with tribal members. And I would think that went a real way, a long way to help appreciate each other. The relocation worked out great for everyone. I think the tribe was glad to have the AT off their land.
I mean, it's also interesting that they put a map on the sign and the reservation is not labeled on the map.
There are lots of signs and historical markers along the Appalachian Trail. You can learn about Civil War battles while hiking through Maryland and about the history of the Park Service while hiking through the Smoky Mountains. But as several of our guests have pointed out, other aspects of American history don't get as much attention. So when I reached this point in the trail, I was keenly aware of the lack of information that was provided about the Skaticook Reservation.
We didn't put any signs up regarding the why the relocation was done or mention of the tribe. But I don't think that was intentional. It just, I don't think, was our priority, really. I think Connecticut is surprising to people because you do have a sense that you're crossing into something different than you've hiked in the South. You're crossing into something that's Yankee in New England. And the landscape the AT crosses in Connecticut does suggest what's up ahead as you continue on north.
I'm walking alongside a gorgeous creek, really clear water, moss-covered rocks. It's beautiful, ferns in the understory. I've got had a hermit thrush sing in and a winter wren just a second ago.
As I approached Massachusetts, the state where I grew up, I could feel the difference that Dave was talking about. But that good feeling was about to end. Find out how after the break. Hey there, adventurers. Are you ready to hit the trail this season? If so, check out Big Agnes, the mother of comfort. Whether you're backpacking, car camping, or sleeping under the stars in your backyard, Big Agnes gear is built for comfort without compromise. Their award-winning sleeping bags, pads, and tents are lightweight, durable, and feel like home, no matter where you roam. Say goodbye to cold, stiff nights, and hello to plush, cozy sleep in the wild or your backyard. Find Big Agnes at an outdoor retailer near you or at bigagnes.com and feel the difference. Big Agnes, comfort built for the backcountry. This is Common Land, a show about the Appalachian Trail. I'm Matt Podolsky.
I woke up this morning and just didn't feel good. I think I definitely had a low fever this morning and just kind of that scratchy feeling in the back of my throat, like I was about to get a sore throat. And I just felt and still feel very lethargic. I had crossed the border from Connecticut into Massachusetts just a few days ago, and I spent the previous day in town. So when I woke up in the morning feeling feverish, I bought a COVID test. The result was negative, which is good. So I decided that I would keep walking today just for half the day and just make it a nice, easy day. So I'm not sure how many miles I'm going to get in, but I will be moving pretty slowly today. It's sort of sinking in, I guess, that it's possible that the rest of this hike for me is going to be a solo hike. And, oh gosh, it's just, it sucks that I feel like right now. Yeah, this is definitely the lowest point on the hike. Before my mom's injury, and before I started to feel sick, I just had this kind of an assumption ingrained in my head that, like, we were gonna make it, right? That we had sort of met each hurdle and gotten past it successfully. And then this situation just kind of took both of us by surprise, both me and my mom. And now I really understand how people could make it this far and drop out and give up. Because even though I've done the majority of the trail, I know that the hardest sections of the trail are ahead of me. Just the fact that I feel like shit right now just makes that feel really daunting. But, you know, I don't know. I don't know what else to do other than to just keep walking. I came very close to just staying in the hotel another day or two. But when that COVID test came back negative, I felt like I just had to keep walking, even if I didn't make it very far. Hopefully that's not a mistake. Hopefully this doesn't get worse. It did get worse, unfortunately. I spent the next 2 days on trail feverish and barely able to swallow any food. I was increasingly lethargic. Every mile was a struggle. So when my sister and her family came to pick me up for a planned weekend break, I asked them to take me to the nearest urgent care.
And sure enough, I went into the urgent care. And after I explained my symptoms and explained that I'd been hiking on the Appalachian Trail, she told me it was almost certainly a tick-borne illness.
You know, if you grow up here, you inevitably know somebody who is at some stage of having just had Lyme disease or has, like, you know, arthritis problems that they associate with Lyme disease. And so these stories are kind of in the ether, even if you've never encountered it directly.
That's Taylor Quimby, a producer at New Hampshire Public Radio and my collaborator on this series. Taylor produced a radio and podcast series called Patient Zero, which took a deep dive into the world of Lyme disease.
Anybody who knows anything about Lyme disease knows that, like, it's a can of worms. And it can be kind of intimidating, actually, because there are people with, like, very passionate stances on a variety of sides that do not, you know, that don't jive well together.
Taylor's series, Patient Zero, explored the origins of Lyme disease, a story that begins with a woman named
Polly Murray. She was this this person who, you know, through really dogged determination and in the face of a lot of dismissal from people in the medical community, really persevered and pushed this issue forward. She was living in Lyme, Connecticut. So this is, of course, where Lyme comes from, the name of the disease. And she has four kids. She was there with her husband. They all basically started to have this constellation of symptoms, things that we would recognize now, you know, swollen joints, aches and pangs, fatigue, and, you know, saw a number of doctors who really said, you know, basically, you're just depressed, Polly, like this isn't a real thing. And ultimately, against the advice of her family doctor, she ended up calling the Connecticut State Health Authorities and got connected with a doctor by the name of Dr. Alan Steer. And then the two of them kind of collaborated. She was able to bring her notes and give all of the information she had gathered to him. He and a number of other people, obviously, I'm like condensing a lot of history here, went on to do the initial investigations that kind of outlined what then was called Lyme arthritis.
Those first cases of Lyme disease, then known as Lyme arthritis, occurred in the 1970s. Since then, Lyme has exploded across the northeastern U.S. and beyond, causing disruption and controversy in the healthcare system.
Because it's so important to start treatment for Lyme with antibiotics right away, before the disease progresses, they prescribed those antibiotics immediately, the doxycycline or whatever it is.
This is one of the most important things to know about Lyme disease. Without immediate treatment with antibiotics, people who contract Lyme disease can wind up with debilitating symptoms that last for months or years. I was extremely lucky to have seen a doctor that recognized the importance of getting me on antibiotics immediately. Many, many others haven't been so lucky.
Doctors want an objective measure. So if you have a very well-defined rash that fits the sort of Lyme stereotype, you know, right off the bat, again, you will almost certainly get diagnosed correctly if you are, you know, in one of these New England states, for example. But not all rashes look exactly the same. And in fact, some people don't get any rashes at all. I think a big piece of, you know, talking about bias, when I did this story initially, I remember the CDC website, you know, it was all white skin.
The healthcare system is riddled with biases, especially when it comes to Lyme disease. In addition to biases based on skin color, there are also geographic biases. In areas where Lyme disease is less common, patients are less likely to be diagnosed correctly. And this bias is complicated by the fact that Lyme is on the move. The disease has been expanding into new environments since the 70s, driven by a number of factors.
Development is a huge, huge piece of the puzzle here. You know, when you take a big patch of forest and you start cutting cul-de-sac after cul-de-sac into these wooded areas, those are spaces that white-footed mice absolutely love. And those mice are a huge, huge part of the life cycle for these ticks that spread Lyme disease.
Development into wooded areas also increases the likelihood that you'll wind up picking up ticks, not just on a hike, but in your backyard. But it isn't just development that is driving changes in the spread and prevalence of Lyme. Climate change is playing an outsized role.
You've been seeing a real measurable rise in Lyme rates in southern parts of Canada, where previously weather conditions were just not great for ticks. You know, we see how the world is changing because of climate change. We can make guesses about what that's going to mean for Lyme disease and other tick-borne illness. We have these different ways of trying to intervene, but all of them have pros and cons, and in many cases are just not as effective as we'd like. And then so much of it seems to come back down to our own behavior and the idea that, like, we could really use a vaccine and you got to put your socks over your pants.
It's day two of hiking after starting to take the antibiotics for Lyme disease. I must say, I feel significantly better than I did yesterday. So just that one pill I took yesterday, I think, is certainly doing something. It's just a lot less
lethargic in the morning, it was a lot easier to motivate myself to get up and pack up all my gear and start hiking. I'm definitely gonna take it easy for these next few days and hope that I continue to feel better. I'm certainly not gonna start pushing big miles again until I'm back to 100%.
Despite my slow pace as I continued my hike through Massachusetts, I was rapidly approaching a key milestone of my hike.
All right, well, it's August 2nd. I'm in Cheshire, Massachusetts, which is the town where I started my first long hike 19 years ago, which means that I just hiked the last mile of the AT. I've hiked every single mile of the trail.
In the summer of 2003, after my freshman year of college, I convinced two of my friends to join me on a 600-mile long backpacking trip. We began our trip in Cheshire, Mass, climbing Mount Greylock, and finished at Katahdin 2 months later. It was my first foray into the world of long-distance hiking, and it planted the seed of desire to thru-hike the entire trail.
Everything I do from here on out is a repeat. But, I'm not going to stop. I'm going to keep going and try to finish this thru-hike. And I know how difficult these last 600 miles are. The antibiotics have definitely kicked in. I would not say I'm at 100% quite yet, but maybe 80. So I'm starting my hike up Mount Greylock, tallest peak in Massachusetts. I can't say it looks familiar yet.
By the time I reached Mount Greylock, just 3 days after being diagnosed with Lyme disease, I had discovered a new energy and motivation to hike. I was eager to enter northern New England, which I knew represented the most rugged and difficult terrain on the trail, but also some of the most spectacular scenery.
Very close to the summit of Lafayette Peak, the highest one on the Franconia Ridgeline.
In our next episode, we'll explore the unique history of trail building in these rugged mountains.
Where anybody can imagine they would want to go with a trail, suddenly you see them building that trail.
And I'll learn that just because my mom got off trail doesn't mean that I'm hiking alone.
My plan is to slow it down and savor every last minute of it and enjoy it and treat it as a vacation.
Common Land is a production of the Wildlands Collective. This season was produced in partnership with New Hampshire Public Radio. This episode was produced by me, your host, Matt Podolsky. Music is by Blue Dot Sessions. To listen to the next episode in the series, just search for Common Land in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. To learn more about the show and to see a full list of credits, go to commonlandpodcast.com.